Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us. We're very excited by the turnout today and, of course, by the topic and the speakers that we have. When Eleanor and I reached out to June to ask her if she'd participate, and she said yes, we knew instantly we'd have a good panel, which has only been made better by the additional speakers we've added. So we're very excited to have them all here today. So June Besick is the executive director of the Kernikin Center for Law, Media, and the Arts at Columbia Law School in New York, where her research and teaching focus on copyright and related rights. She currently serves on the American Bar Association's Intellectual Property Law Section and is a former chair of the section's Copyright Division and the Copyright Reform Task Force. She serves on the editorial board of the Journal of the Copyright Society of the USA and the board of advisors on the Columbia Journal of Law and the Arts. She's also a member of the board of Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts New York, and I'm sure many other organizations are glad to have her participate. She is the author of many articles and studies on copyright law issues. She earned her law degree from New York University School of Law and her undergraduate degree in economics from Yale University. So with that, I'll hand it over to June, who will give a brief presentation on the topic, and then we'll open up to a panel discussion. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm going to start by introducing my co-panelists here. To my left is Tucker McCrady, who's a shareholder at Greenberg Traurig, where he focuses on entertainment law with an emphasis on copyright, intellectual property, contracts and dispute resolution, and particularly guiding service providers through the thicket of challenges inherent to digital music. Before he was at Greenberg, he worked in-house at Warner Music Group, where he negotiated digital music agreements with all of the major providers in the industry. There's a much more detailed bio of both, all of the panelists in your materials, so I'm going to try to keep it short. Now I'm going to turn to Gianni Servididio, who is a partner at Jenner & Block, where he focuses on the intersection of IP law, technology, and the internet. He's represented major motion picture studios and record companies in several of the leading digital copyright infringement cases of the past decade, including Arista Records against Usenet in the Southern District of New York, and a case involving pre-1972 sound recordings and the applicability of the DMCA, in particular the notice and takedown provision. So he'll have an opportunity to talk about that further during the course of our discussion. With that introduction, I am going to give a brief history of pre-1972 sound recordings and how they got to be pre-1972 sound recordings. I want to just say, I know there are a lot of people in the room who have a lot of expertise on this, so I beg your pardon, but I wanted to give a little basic information for those of you who do not have a lot of expertise on pre-72 sound recordings. I also want to say I feel totally vindicated by being here today because my now 20-year-old son has been antagonizing me for the last 10 years because he thinks that pre-1972 sound recordings are not a worthwhile endeavor in terms of spending my time. So I am going to mention that we were sold out today. I know I'm going to get some snappy response, but anyway, all right. So let me just, okay. Now, I want to make a distinction between sound recordings and musical works. Now, the sound recording is the work that results from the fixation of a series of musical, spoken, or other sounds, regardless of how they're embodied. And the musical work is the musical composition, including the music and lyrics of a song. So many sound recordings, when you get a CD, have more than one copyrighted work in it. I just want to mention, though, to reemphasize that many sound recordings aren't based on musical compositions, and a lot of the ones that we're talking about here today are not. For example, a sound recording can be based on lectures, books, nature sounds, interviews, and all those kinds of things. So there are lots of different kinds of sound recordings. Now, I want to give an example of the kinds of things we're talking about. I always have to do this with the students because they kind of equate pre-1972 with medieval, you know? And so I want to mention, and that, you know, I have this list because I keep trying to go till I hit somebody that they've heard of. So for example, commercial sound recordings, classical, soul, jazz, blues, country pop, and then you have, you know, Frank Sinatra, Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, Elvis, Motown, Stevie Wonder, etc. And this season you have to think about sound recordings like Bing Crosby and White Christmas, which we all hear over and over again, or Andy Williams and It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year. So these get play only in December, but they get a lot of play in December.
And October and November.
And October and November, right after Halloween, or even before. So again, I want to emphasize, though, a lot of unpublished works are in this category. Now, the commercial sound recordings get all the attention, but the unpublished works are probably the majority. So you've got these oral histories, nature recordings, archival versions of radio shows, outtakes, and then you've got reporters' notes of their interviews, which are in a lot of different libraries. Okay, sound recordings and copyright. Sound recordings were created in the mid-19th century, but only in a very rudimentary version. And, it took a long time to really have an effective, viable market with sound recordings. In the 1909 Act, however, sound recordings were not included as copyrightable subject matter. Now, there are a couple reasons for this. If you think back to 1909, that was right after 1908, and White Smith against Apollo, where the Supreme Court held that the piano roll was not a copy of a musical composition. It wasn't a copy because they couldn't read it. It didn't look like a musical composition to them. There were no little notes, nothing like that. So that could not be a copy in their view. But if it's not a copy for purposes of infringement, then it's also not a copy for purposes of fixation. Now, musical compositions had no problem with fixation because they could be fixed through sheet music. But there was no other way, really, to fix sound recordings, so that was a problem. The other reason, I think, for non-inclusion was there was a lot of discomfort about whether there was authorship in sound recordings. Well, we've obviously overcome that over time, but if you look at other countries, it's this authorship issue that makes sound recordings be treated under neighboring rights rather than under copyright. It's why you still have two WIPO treaties, one's for phonograms or sound recordings, and the other one is for copyrighted works. But anyway, so from 1909 on, gradually views shifted and people came to realize that sound recordings could be included under copyright, but the thought was they'd be included in the new act, The new act, which they worked on through the 1950s and the 1960s, But sound recordings, the need to protect them became more urgent. And the General Copyright Revision was not going as quickly as they had hoped. So in 1971, Congress passed the Sound Recording Amendment, which said that sound recordings on a going forward basis would be included in federal copyright law. The effective date of that was February 15th, 1972. So that's the date. So pre-1972 really means pre-February 15th, 1972. But sound recordings got no public performance right. So keep that in mind because that becomes quite relevant later. So just a few years after the sound recording amendment, you get to the 1976 Copyright Act. And essentially, the sound recording protection was kept the same. Although state law was preempted from most other works, all the unpublished works were folded into federal copyright, but pre-72 were always a thing apart. But there were some changes to the law, and one was in the provisions that have to do with whether federal law will govern in all cases. And in this case, there was kind of a sunset provision for sound recordings because they wanted to make sure that even though state law was going to govern, they wouldn't be protected forever. So the idea was as of February 15th, 2047, as it was passed originally, all state law would cease and no federal law could kick in then for pre-72 sound recordings. And that date, the 2047 was later changed to 2067 as part of the Copyright Term Extension Act. Now, another thing which will either clarify or obfuscate certain things is the Uruguay Round Agreements Act. So I've said, pre-72 sound recordings are protected by state law. Well, that's true, sort of, kind of. There's a big group of pre-72 sound recordings that are protected by federal law, and those are foreign sound recordings that were brought back into federal copyright under the Uruguay Round Agreements Act, which is copyright restoration. Now, in a way, it's kind of odd to call it copyright restoration since they were never eligible for federal copyright when they were first created, but that's what we call them. But in order to be eligible for restoration, a sound recording had to be in copyright in its home country on the effective date of the Act, which is January 1st, 1996. And basically, since in most countries the term of protection for sound recordings was 50 years, that means, as a rule of thumb, you can assume anything from 46 on as a foreign sound recording is going to be protected by federal copyright. But that's all foreign. The U.S. are in this different category. All right, these are the basic rights in sound recordings. And you all know them, so I won't go through them, except to say that the public performance right for sound recordings is very limited, and I will come back to that later. Now, for state law protection, it's quite different. So the protection varies from state to state. They might base it on unfair competition, misappropriation, common law copyright, or state statutes. The scope of rights can differ from state to state. The exceptions are ambiguous. Because of the fact that most of the cases involve commercial sound recordings, there's very little law on what rights somebody, a nonprofit user, might have. And then the term of protection can last until 2067. Now, that doesn't mean it must last. The states have discretion as to whether they want to end it sooner. And I think Colorado does end it sooner. Right now, California does. But because a lot of these causes of action are like, you know, unfair competition, they don't have an inherent end to them. But just to show you what that means, a musical composition published in 1922 is in the public domain. It went into the public domain in 1997. But a sound recording that was from 1922 could be protected until 2067. So that's a very long time. And this is very troublesome for people who work in libraries and archives and who want to study sound recordings. Now, another case that kind of made things more complicated was Capitol Records against Naxos, which many of you probably have heard of. But this was a case that had to do with very old foreign sound recordings. Now, they were too old to be brought back into federal copyright. And so there was a lawsuit for infringement of those recordings. And a New York State court held that New York protects pre-72 sound recordings under common law copyright until 2067. A sound recording in the public domain in the home country can still be protected under New York law. And here was the difficult aspect for a lot of nonprofits. In New York, a claim does not require bad faith, commercial benefit, or commercial competition. So that was what gave libraries pause. There's this broad right, and as part of the cause of action, you don't need to show any commercial involvement. So part of the impetus for federalization was from the library community. They wanted to achieve greater availability of pre-72 sound recordings, clarify applicable exceptions, and then, of course, clarify applicable rights. And they wanted to get the oldest ones into the public domain. So the Copyright Office was commissioned to do a study, and they, you know, got written comments, had roundtables, et cetera. And in December 2011, they released their study. And in a nutshell, they decided that copyright protection should apply to sound recordings before February 15, 1972. But there had to be special provisions to address things like ownership, registration, term of protection, and so on. Ownership, I think you can see that if the transition from state to federal would create a change in ownership, then you were going to have a takings problem. And so that's why they decided it would be good if the person who owned under state law the last day before federalization would be the owner on the first day of federalization, you wouldn't have a change, and then that would be the fair way to do it. Now, in the term of protection, basically, it gave all works a certain term of protection. I'm not going to go into this in great detail because it's complicated. All works got a certain term of federal protection. But works that were pre-1923 at most could get 25 years of protection. You had to file in the Copyright Office and do certain things if it's pre-23. The thought behind that is these are so old at this point that we're not going to give them until 2067. And then anything from 23 to 72 could get the full term of protection beyond that transition period. What you had to do to get this extra period was to make the sound recording available to the public, file a notice in the Copyright Office, and keep making the sound recording available to the public. Now, they wanted to avoid the situation where somebody brings it out, a special edition, you know, for 6 months or 2 months or 2 days, and then says, oh, well, I made it available, and then it disappears again. And that's actually been happening in Europe because they have this use it or lose it provision there. So there's general concerns about doing anything with the Copyright Act, and if you've been following the testimony before Congress over the last year, you know that people are terrified that Congress is going to reopen the Copyright Act for anything because they might make a muck of it. So there's that general. Okay, and then there's the possibility of upsetting expectations against ownership, expectations concerning ownership. There's the potential earlier termination of rights, those older recordings that are only going to get 25 years. And then there's the expense of copyright registration because, you know, these works haven't been registered because they're not eligible to be registered, and so somebody's going to have to go in and register them all. All right, this brings us to the webcasting issue. As you know, under federal law, there's a limited public performance right for digital audio transmission of sound recordings. Specifically for webcasting, and this is very simplistic, it's more complicated than this, but for webcasting, there's a statutory license. You do it, you don't have to get permission, but you do have to pay. And then if it's for on-demand streaming, you have to negotiate a license. But of course, this webcasting license doesn't pertain to pre-72 sound recording because they're not in federal under federal protection. So right holders want to be compensated for streaming pre-72 sound recordings. And actually, there's a bill in Congress right now to bring pre-72 sound recordings under the webcasting license. But a lot of people say if you're going to do it, you should do the full federalization because librarians and archivists who thought federalization would be a good idea think, well, why should they get the benefit of federalization? But we don't get the exceptions. I mean, that seems unfair. And in the meantime, you have record companies who've sued Pandora and Sirius under state law for public performance royalties for streaming pre-72 sound recordings. Now, the defense in these suits was that no explicit state law recognition up until this time of a public performance right, and business practices don't support one. Nobody's ever paid for public performance on the state level that at least I'm aware of. Well, with the exception of some people who tried to use the federal mechanism but ultimately decided that wasn't going to work. So, this is my last slide. So, there have been two cases decided recently that held that there's a public performance right for pre-72 sound recordings, one in California and one in New York. But what's interesting about these cases is that it goes beyond webcasting. Webcasting is a federal invention. These cases have said there's a full public performance right. So where on the federal level, the broadcasters are, terrestrial broadcasters don't have to pay anything for public performance of sound recordings. On the state level, that's at best for the broadcasters unclear, and at worst, they do have an obligation to pay. So that really changes the whole dynamic because the broadcasters now may be supportive of federalization because that would get them off the hook for paying for pre-72 sound recordings that they broadcast. And face it, for everybody, that statutory license is an easy means of administering. You don't have to go to everybody and negotiate. You have a means of using them. So that's basically where we are right now. I just want to add that these decisions are likely to be appealed. Certainly in New York, I think there's a reasonable possibility that the case will be certified to the state court. That Capitol Records against Naxos case I mentioned earlier, when it got to the Second Circuit sent it to the New York Court of Appeals, and the New York Court of Appeals decided it, and then it sent it back to the Second Circuit, and that could happen again here. And both of these cases are cases of first impression under the state law. I would venture to say that I'd be surprised, though, at the end of the day, if the result was that there was no state law public performance right for sound recordings. Because, in fact, these are matters of common law to some extent, and as the way in which you exploit sound recordings has shifted from selling copies to streaming, that's something that a state common law court would be cognizant of in determining whether, it's fair and right that people should not be compensated for something like that. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the panelists, and I'm going to pose some questions to them. But for both of you, I'd like you to talk about the rationale of these state law cases. I mean, how do they get around this aspect where, for 60 years, nobody's paid for it, and now they have to?
Well, I'll just speak a little to the, can you hear me? I'll speak a little to the California case, talk about the rationale there, which was similar but not entirely the same as the New York case. In California, there's actually a statute on the books, which I think helped the plaintiffs saying that an author of an original work of authorship consisting of a sound recording initially fixed prior to February 15th, 1972, has an exclusive ownership therein until February 15th, 2047. So it's left up to the court to determine what having an exclusive ownership means. There's also an exception. The exception is that it does not apply to one who independently makes or duplicates another sound recording that doesn't directly or indirectly recapture the actual sounds fixed in the prior recording, but consists entirely of an independent fixation and so on. In other words, if you make a cover recording or even what's known as a sound-alike recording, a recording that's intended to sound basically just like the original but with a new singer and a new band, it's, you know, it's freshly recorded, that is not considered an infringement under the California statute.
And that's true under federal law as well.
Yes. Yeah. There was a lot of back and forth, obviously, amongst the litigants about what this means. With, I think, the defense pounding the table of common sense, saying there is nobody's what June was saying before. There's nobody's ever paid for these rights. Who would think that you would pay for them? This has been going on for a century. What are you talking about? As opposed to the logical argument of. Well, what does the statute actually say, and what can it mean? And the court found that the exception actually bolstered the case that there was a performance right. In other words, the court took the perspective that there is a sort of natural zone of copyright protection that extends over works, and within that natural zone, performance rights fall. And because the statute felt a particular need to call out this one exception for cover recordings or sound-alike recordings and did not call out any of the exceptions in the federal statute, that therefore they didn't mean to capture the exceptions in the federal statute. And of course, in the federal statute, it does carve out performance rights, particularly back in 72 before there was a digital performance rights, as an exception to the rights granted to the holder of a copyright in a sound recording. I think I'll put that on pause for a second, and why don't we talk about the New York case and how that differed.
Great. So New York case was brought by the same plaintiffs, which was owners of the rights and the masters for the Turtles. And the claim was the same. Under New York law, it was common law copyright infringement and unfair competition. Can everyone hear me okay? I think the starting point really for both decisions is the point that common law operates completely independently and free of the federal system. So common law rules don't, particularly in New York, under the authority going back for decades, are flexible, they're adaptive, and they look at copyrights holistically, not by a federal approach, which is more driven by enumerated statutory rights. So at least in New York, the law is and always has been that pre-72 recordings are incredibly commercially and artistically valuable. They're iconic. They have inherent value both commercially, artistically, and that value can't just be taken by someone else for a commercial purpose. That was sort of a hornbook rule of New York law that really influenced the way the courts looked at the decision. So Sirius is a non-interactive streaming service. They are using these pre-72 recordings to stream to users. The claim in New York, and I believe it was also in California, was twofold. One, Sirius was making an unauthorized reproduction of the works because they weren't just streaming them; they were copying them in multiple ways, including permanent copies made to New York servers, and then they were using those permanent copies to stream. So the claim was common law copyright infringement, and unfair competition. The defense was twofold. One, on the reproduction, it doesn't really capture this because we're not also distributing, and whatever reproduction we make is fair use. And on the public performance point, there is no such right of public performance. And Judge McMahon, in a pretty exhaustive opinion, analyzed common law copyright and said there's no basis to exclude public performance from the bundle of rights that are commonly associated with common law copyright. And so she looked at plays, she looked at film clips, and she said there's no there's no reason to treat these differently. And as Tucker was saying, she looked at the exception under the Federal Copyright Act for sound recording protection and said, since they needed to carve out the public performance right in 1971 in creating the right, that sort of suggests the opposite of what the serious defendants were arguing. It suggests that that right existed under common law and wasn't carved out. So the result was the same in both cases, but the arguments were slightly different because of the law in those two states.
I just want to add that it's actually kind of funny to read the opinions because both courts kind of say, well, I know no one's brought a suit for, 60, 70 years, but no one ever asked us before, if there was a right or not,
And I can just respond to the issue that is, well, why aren't these rights enforced before? And I think the answer is twofold. The technology is relatively new of digital streaming, and the business model particularly have changed. They've evolved, just like the law evolves. In New York, the law, Naxos says the law can change to meet differences in technology, can adapt. Well, business models also need to adapt. What was a perfectly rational business model in the age of where sales of physical copies were your primary source of revenue, it might be perfectly rational under that regime to say, I'm not going to enforce my broad common law rights against public performances because they're not eating into my sales. Well, music has changed, and we've gone from a model where people are purchasing to a model where people are paying for access. And in that world, streaming pre-72 recordings, whether it's interactively or on demand, is directly competing with the record companies, the owners of those sound recordings, attempt to monetize their own products. So I think that, in part, helped the court get around this 60-year absence of enforcement.
Although I'm not sure which way that cuts, that argument, in that, in response to the change of business models where it became possible to stream something online to the point where the on-demand streaming might substitute for actual ownership, Congress put in place a sort of balancing act where they said, well, if you're streaming on demand, you have to negotiate a license. But if you're not streaming on demand, if you're streaming non-interactively via regular terrestrial radio or via internet streaming radio, you don't have to ask for permission. We're going to leave that scheme in place, which has always favored which has been the status quo for a very long time. We're going to leave that in place. Now, they also added a payment right. In terms of the, whether the original setup that sound recordings were streamed on radio and radio-like services without permission was left intact.
Right, but I think I agree with that, and I think. But you look at the federal act, and what's clear is that there is some for post-72 recordings. There is compensation that is required before you can engage in either on-demand or non-interactive streaming. It's difficult to sort of see the rationale analogizing to the federal act to say there is no right whatsoever against that exact conduct under state law. I don't think you can reconcile those two. And there can be a legitimate debate about the propriety of how you're going to implement the enforcement of that right if one's recognized under common law, whether you need to do something like a compulsory license or not. But I don't think you can say that supports the notion there is no right whatsoever under state law to get a revenue for the use of these works via streaming.
Although state laws differ, and we can't be sure that other states would go the same way. As a matter of fact, at least a couple states have on record statutes that prohibit performance right. However, these particular states weren't randomly chosen, as I'm sure you all recognize. And I think it's indicative of the way we're going, assuming these are upheld on appeal or by the state courts. But what basically do you think they do mean? I mean, if they're upheld on appeal, what are the implications? I mean, we don't have for state law a kind of sound exchange type clearinghouse, an efficient way of doing it, and then there's the issue of the full public performance right and the non-digital types of performance. And how do you think this will end up working itself out?
I think the market is going to take care of it. I mean, I think there are ways that rights owners have had under both federal and state law to deal with this. For example, owners of rights in musical compositions have broad right of public performance and always had. And there have been performing rights organizations that have come together over the years to administer those rights. So radio broadcasters have to pay for those performance rights and have been able to do so and still stay in business. I think another point is that on-demand streaming services, the Spotifys of the world, currently have to negotiate and obtain the rights to stream recordings, and those negotiations currently include pre-72 rights. So they're already paying for the right, the on-demand services are already paying for the right to do this conduct. So this isn't the controversial point I think that some people think that it might be. Who's it going to impact? The Pandoras of the world, the Siriuses of the world, and potentially the terrestrial radio stations. And I think there'll be incentives on both sides to come to do a deal. You've got rights owners that want to license their work, and you've got these services that want to be able to perform these sound recordings. I think they'll be able to come to a resolution. That's my sense.
Well, I think there's no question that the market will come to some sort of resolution eventually. That usually is the case. But I don't know that there's any way to look at these two cases in the short term, if they were both upheld and nothing further was done on the federal level, as anything other than a complete disaster for almost everyone involved. Sorry if that sounds like hyperbole, but just to walk through it a little bit. Every bar and restaurant has got to be worried now about getting sued by pre-72 sound recording officers, to the extent anyone has a jukebox in their bar that plays a pre-72 sound recording. And if I were advising any bar and restaurant, which I'm not, not currently, I would say it'd be good to take all those old sound recordings out of your jukeboxes and make sure you're only playing new ones. Because the new ones are safe, you can play them for free, but the old ones you can't, and I would just stop playing them. I don't know that that's good for owners of pre-72 sound recordings. I don't know that that's good for the public. It's certainly not getting any more money into the pockets of pre-72 sound recordings, and certainly not promoting the albums at all. The same kind of panic is going to happen with regards to terrestrial broadcasting stations. Now, it may be that some of the largest terrestrial broadcasting stations will be able to go back and dig up a lot of the information on who the owners of various jazz recordings are in order to keep these not top 40 stations, but the sort of smaller stations, the artier stations that play older material. It may be that they can figure out a way to license that. I don't know that that's necessarily something that the market is going to spring to solve so quickly. And then finally, I wonder whether, to what extent this even helps the artists. And what I mean by that is that a lot of these old sound recordings are controlled by record companies and labels. They were sold off long ago with a royalty rate going back to the artists. In many cases, even some of the very old acts are not recouped, such that this is essentially handing a litigation right to large record companies, but may not, and small record companies as well, but may not necessarily be helping the artists out at all. And so, although this may be a boon to litigation on a certain level, I'm not sure that it's, again, without further involvement of Congress, I'm not sure that it's necessarily a positive step by itself.
And those are all like tough examples. I think the easy example is the example presented by companies like Sirius, who are just huge, for-profit companies who are selling a subscription service with incredibly popular channels, songs from hits from the 60s, classic vinyl. These are just like the overt monetization of pre-72 recordings for enormous dollars. Those are the litigants that are before the court, not the bar owners, the restaurants. And you're right, there's maybe a cloud that will need to be sorted out by common law courts, and they can be on a case-by-case basis. I think it's a much, much tougher and more complicated case if you're going to start suing some of the examples that you gave, but those aren't the cases that are being dealt with right now.
Well, yeah, but even in the case of Sirius, I mean, it may well turn out that owners of jazz recordings weren't getting paid before this decision, and that they won't be getting paid after the decision either, because Sirius won't have the market facilities in place for negotiating these licenses, and they'll just stop playing those channels, in which case, again, I'm not sure who's been helped by that.
It reminds me of what happened in the wake of Ticini, where the Times and other databases pull the articles at the request of the authors, and then the authors were like, "What do you mean you pulled our articles?" And it could be a very similar response. But you know, when you look at the various interest groups, you have to consider how this might affect the possibility of federalization. So, you know, who's going to gain and who's going to lose? And 2 years ago, you might have thought, well, the owners of pre-72 sound recordings would be better off with federalization because they would be getting a income stream from streaming. And in fact, now it looks like maybe they're not going to be getting something. Maybe they're going to be losing something if you fold pre-72 sound recordings into federal law. So I just wondered how you think overall this might affect whether sound recordings would be federalized, pre-72 sound recordings would be federalized, and do you think it's a good idea?
I think federalization is a complicated question. I think, you know, I think the one thing I feel strongly about is you can't pick and choose what rights you federalize and don't federalize. So, for example, holding that owners of pre-72 recordings are subject to federal defenses under the Copyright Act, but not providing them with any of the other advantages of federalization seems like an impossible position to justify. Whether pre-72s in toto should come under the federal scheme, I think it's extremely complicated. Your copyright report that you helped work on did an incredibly good job laying out all the different competing interests. And I mean, my just concern is you've got state law, which has been around for a century, that has ascribed these rights and sort of, you know, there's a system in place right now where there's some sense of who owns the rights as a matter of state law, and then you're going to import all that law, all that common law, 50 states, into the federal statute. It's going to be extremely messy. I know the current situation from the other side is it's also pretty messy, but I don't know. I think here you're sort of, it's not a great solution either way you look at it, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Particularly the point that extending defenses under the Act without extending the benefits is probably not equitable. From the service side perspective, anything that comes close to being a streamlined, efficient process for getting things licensed certainly helps music services get up and running. I think if you go to any copyright owner and say, "Hey, guess what? We're going to pass a law saying that you have no control over your copyright anymore, but we're going to set a rate and we'll have a court sitting in the Library of Congress decide what that rate is going to be. Aren't you happy?" I think most copyright owners would say, "No, I'm not happy." And yet, history is filled with such examples. And when you go back and try to take that kind of right back or to rescind that, it's sometimes the copyright owners that fight the hardest to retain it. All of which is to say that I think federalization is probably a great idea. Now, what federalization means is a more complicated question, but I think to the extent that you're federalizing and bringing certainty to the marketplace, that could never hurt in the music arena where things are far too complicated and messy as they are.
Another difference between federal and state law, which John, I'd like you to address, is the DMCA notice and takedown rules and how they affect federal versus state sound recordings.
Right. Well, the starting point for this analysis is 301C of the Copyright Act, which is the statute which says, and to paraphrase, nothing in the Copyright Act shall annul or limit any rights or remedies under state law. And that was sort of the whole part of, you know, in federalizing in the 1976 Act, federalizing copyrights, there was this intent by Congress just to leave untouched the law of the states and say absolutely nothing that we do in the federal act is going to impact state law rights. That, interestingly enough, that's 301C was passed, was that in 1976 or 71?
301C, that was 76.
Yeah, so that was passed in 1976, and then it was amended, I think twice, including in 1995, to extend the term of protection for pre-72 rights. And it was within the exact same month that Congress was amending 301C to say, hands off federal law, you can't touch state law rights, Congress also enacted the DMCA, which was the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is a limitation on liability for the assertion of federal rights. So what's happened is that litigants have brought suit against on pre-72, and the defendants have asserted a defense under the DMCA saying that I can have safe harbor against this state law infringement claim under the Federal Copyright Act. And believe it or not, because it as a matter of sort of pure statutory construction, that position is crazy. But believe it or not, there's a split in courts. And why is it crazy? Because 301C is absolutely clear. And if you read the DMCA, the limitations on liability, you have to sort of really stretch and contort yourself to say that when they said infringement of copyright in section 512, which is a defined term to mean infringement of federal copyrights, that, oh, Congress really meant to cover pre-72 and sort of preempt 301C by implication. So that's sort of the position going in if you're going to assert this defense as against a pre-72 claim. But the countervailing considerations are courts are sympathetic to genuine internet service providers, and there's a and they want to sort of, as a matter of policy, maybe recognize that there's some need for defenses to secondary liability. So those are the competing considerations, and it has caused courts to come out different ways. There's a Judge Pauly decision in federal court, which is somewhat of an outlier, I believe, that says that those rights are pre-72 claims are subject to a DMCA defense. And the Copyright Office report sort of roundly criticized MP3 tunes in a very good analysis, and said you can't reconcile it with the statute. And why? Because if Judge Pauly was right, then the DMCA would apply in states where state law rights are discussed in terms of copyright infringement, but not in terms of unfair competition. So there's this sort of hodgepodge of ways state law protects pre-72 rights. In some states, it's a cause of action for infringement. In those states, you'd have a DMCA defense. But where it's conversion or misappropriation or unfair competition, you'd have no DMCA defense. So the New York courts have come out the opposite way on it in the UMG v. Skate Media case, and that's where it currently stands.
With that, I think I'm going to open it to questions from the floor, and I hope some of you at least have questions. Yes, Bob.
For Tucker, you're hypothetical about the bar owner you were concerned about. Why wouldn't latches be a defense as to a bar owner or an analog radio operator who's been doing the same thing since A Hard Day's Night came out, as opposed to a streaming service, which is a new development?
Well, one might ask, Oh, yes. Yeah. So the question is, for the bar owner who's playing It's a Hard Day's Night, although I think technically A Hard Day's Night being a British composition recording that's been restored is probably not.
Chuck Berry.
Yeah, exactly. No, I didn't know if we had gotten that little wrinkle in.
That was good.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I thought you'd like that, Jim. But for Chuck Berry, if the bar's been playing the Chuck Berry song for 50 years, wouldn't a latches defense apply to someone coming along to claim an infringement there? Unfortunately for bars and restaurants, latches claims were raised in both of the Flo and Eddie cases. And in both of the cases, they were dismissed on the theory that the latches claim conflicted with the statutory the statute of limitations, and essentially they're saying if you're doing away, what is the purpose of the statute of limitations if you've got a latches claim? That's what the statute of limitations is for if you're talking about an action for damages, and these are actions for damages, so it doesn't apply. And both the New York and the California court agreed with that.
Okay, others right back here, in front of me.
I think one of the panelists pointed out correctly that these cases could be the basis of litigation, for instance, on behalf of legacy artists against not only nightclubs, but terrestrial radio. In fact, the judge in New York invited that kind of litigation by writing that acquiescence by participants in the recording industry in a status quo where recording artists and producers are not getting paid, while songwriters are, does not show that they lacked an enforceable right. Only that they failed to act on it. So my question is this. For many years now, the recording industry has been trying to get Congress to change the law to give a public performance right it's a sound recording, so they could get terrestrial radio, the networks, to pay them something. And Congress hasn't done this because the terrestrial broadcasters are represented by the AP, have been able to preserve the status quo. Don't these cases give the recording industry more leverage to get protection for sound recordings so they can finally get terrestrial radio to pay up?
I mean, I don't think you can't look at what's happening on the state level and make predictions about changing the federal act. They're just two completely independent situations and bodies. And I guess my only thought is that why is it such a controversial proposition that owners of musical compositions are entitled to get paid for their performances, but not owners of sound recordings? I don't see that as inherently problematic. I think the status quo is the status quo, but I just, as a conceptual matter, I don't understand why that causes such consternation.
As a political matter, though, I understand why it does. And, it's interesting. I wonder if the National Association of Broadcasters might be in favor of federalization now, because there is no broad public performance right under federal law, and maybe they think now federalization would be a good idea. It would get them out from under some of this.
My guess is no.
All right. Do you want to explain, Tucker?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I just say a little bit about that. The NAB is not a client of mine, and so I'm just speculating here. And if they were a client, I wouldn't be able to speculate. So, but I think at this point, as the NAB, you're very likely looking at potential federalization and judging the benefits and the costs. And the benefits are pretty clear. You get to keep your jazz and oldie stations, and the costs are pretty clear as well. You're subject to a royalty payment that you've never had to pay before. And if I were running a radio station, I think I know which side of that argument I'd want to be on.
The other thing is on the state level, if it stays a matter of state law, I think the NAB is probably quite capable of getting exceptions in the states that would pertain to their people. Yeah.
You express one of the issues being if record companies were able to get this income stream, contractually they might not be obligated to account to artists under their contracts. And you have Philly's music case in New York, other cases which are pretty tough on artists who are locked into old contracts. In New York, at least, do you think that the more general common law claims other than common law copyright, like misappropriation and unfair competition, would give artists themselves standing in these kinds of claims? Well, the Turtles case, they own the Turtles reacquired their sound recording, so that wasn't an issue specifically there.
The question was whether artists would have standing to bring unfair competition-like claims under New York law, and I think I don't see any reason why they wouldn't if they have the if they own the rights, if they haven't assigned them to somebody else. There's nothing to prevent them from bringing an unfair competition claim.
Although I think your question was directed at whether, despite contractual difficulties, in other words, if the ownership still remained with a label that the artist did not control. And if the to the extent that the label owed royalties but had paid large advances in the past that had never been recouped, might they have an independent way via misappropriation? Perhaps that wasn't.
No, I think that's right.
Question. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that it would. I'm not that familiar with misappropriation law, but I would be surprised if it gave a right to someone who didn't own the asset in question.
Yeah, I mean, one of the elements of the claim is to show ownership of the right. So I don't know that scenario would work.
The only cases I remember seeing where the performer was a plaintiff or their estate were cases like where a radio had done, a reproduction of the performance so they could show it at a different time. Say it was over Christmas or something, and then the radio station went defunct. But the radio station went defunct, so there was no other party there, and so then. The performer was making the claim on behalf of the performer of the estate. But most of the cases involve the record companies rather than the performers. Yeah.
I read that there's a 1940s Learned Hand case that apparently holds that there's no, that common law copyright does not extend to performance and broadcast. And apparently it's just been introduced into the Turtles case, and I wondered if anyone could comment on that.
Yeah, the other question was whether Learned Hand in 1940 single-handedly abdicated the right of public performance under New York common law. I'm putting my little spin on it because I have a microphone. You're talking about the RCA v. Whiteman case, which basically held that the sale of a phono record with a restrictive label that said not for public performance. That court basically held that sale was a dedication of all rights associated with that sound recording to the public. And one of the rights that Judge Learned Hand found to have been dedicated to the public was the right for a radio broadcaster to broadcast that record. So that's 1940. And then 15 years later, in the Mercury Records case, the Second Circuit reversed, saying that as a matter of New York law, as developed by Metropolitan Opera, there is no dedication to the public through the sale of a physical copy of a sound recording. So I know the losing party in the Turtles case has tried to cite Whiteman as a basis for reconsideration. But I think that's a very tough argument to make, because Whiteman was reversed over a very strong dissent by Hand, basically recognizing that if you read Hand's dissent in Mercury Records, which is the losing view, his view is that there is a broad, unencumbered bundle of rights associated with sound recordings, and when you sell a sound recording to the public, that's not a dedication of all those rights for anybody to use. So that's, I don't think that case is going to change the outcome.
Yeah. On behalf of the unrepresented bar owners of Greenwich Village, I would like to suggest that since latches is an equitable defense and estoppel is another equitable defense, if the owners of these rights started suing a lot of bar owners, maybe it wouldn't come out the same way.
A suggestion that perhaps courts would view latches in the context of a bar or restaurant differently than they view it in the context of a digital streaming service. That's possible.
Or estoppel.
And estoppel. Johnny, do you know why estoppel was not raised in these cases? I wondered that in reading them.
I'm not sure, other than maybe estoppel requires some more of an affirmative act than to assert as a defense.
In the patent law context, I know that estoppel can, inaction and silence can be considered enough of an action sometimes to get you in trouble for estoppel as the patent owner. But I didn't know if there's a copyright analogy.
There's definitely an estoppel defense and an acquiescence waiver.
Right here.
Yeah. I may be jumping ahead a little bit, but. Let's say that Congress, I mean, I know that and Jerry Nadler or Nadler or whatever is going to be talking here in January, and he's involved in these copyright issues in the Judiciary Committee, IP Department, IP Division of the Judiciary Committee. And one of the things he's talked about is the sort of challenge between piecemeal reform of various issues, that are at stake in the copyright discussion versus an omnibus bill. But let's say that the pre-72 sound recordings were to be federalized. And it's my understanding also that the nature of the effect of radio airplay as a pure promotional vehicle for the sale of records is not the same factor that it was, 20 years ago, let's say. I mean, now artists are making money directly from Sound Exchange for their streaming exposure. So why wouldn't a performing rights organization like a Sound Exchange be assigned, if it ever were federalized, and let's say radio had to pay some percentage like they do to the RMLC rates for the music publishing and composition side, why wouldn't there be a collection you know, scheme so that artists would get paid directly off the top as opposed to the labels to recoup against their unearned balance. They do for streaming now. In a sense, why wouldn't that parallel sort of situation be the case for terrestrial radio?
So the question is, if we were ever to federalize pre-72s.
And change the public performance, right, under federal law.
Right, and change the public performance. But I assume you mean by federalizing pre-72s in the sense of having performance rights both for digital but also for terrestrial, is that what you're asking? Yeah. Why in that case we wouldn't necessarily replicate the sound exchange model where 50% of the revenues would go to the sound recording copyright owner, which is usually a record label, and 50% would go directly to the artist regardless of recoupment under their contracts with the record labels and regardless of whether you know, they retained any actual ownership rights in that sound recording. My answer is I don't know why we wouldn't. I think you're probably right. I think as a political matter, that's very likely how it would play out, is that you would have some, in terms of balancing everybody's interests and getting as many parties on board as possible, I'm sure that's very likely what Congress would do.
I will say, in opposition to the attempts to get a public performance right in federal law, the broadcasters have said, they always say we're helping them, but they also say, well, but it wouldn't be right because none of this really goes to the artists anyway. So having made that argument repeatedly, it would be hard for them to say, well, we object to this assessment because some of it goes to the artists. Anybody else?
Yeah. As the only non-lawyer in the room, my understanding is the whole constitutional basis of copyright that it's to incentivize creation. I can't see that this restoration would incentivize anything except the creation of lawsuits.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just in law doesn't protect property interests. New York common law doesn't, in particular, doesn't protect copyright interests merely to incentivize creation. It's to sort of reward the artistic and commercial value of works, and that could be to the creators, to the heirs, to the ongoing promotion, the marketing of the works. They're viable commercial properties. So I don't think that's the only reason to policy consideration to give rights. And if that were the case, then you couldn't have extended the Federal Copyright Act.
Well, that applies to people still creating. They're still getting that extension, but not in this case.
The Supreme Court has dealt with this a number of times, and they've always rejected that argument. In addition, the constitutional basis is not only to incentivize creation, but distribution. So there was certainly an argument that it would enhance distribution. Okay, with that, I think we're going to close, and I thank you very much, and I thank our panelists.